And we do
well,
not
the thing
have
is, any of these
hi,
type of
this
foods.
Has arrived. Call to order the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water, and welcome members, welcome audience. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3571. This was carried over from Thursday. Liz, you want to remind us and the vast listening public what this bill would do?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3571 would assign ownership of renewable energy certificates to the owner of the facility generating the renewable energy that resulted in the certificate. It would also allow owners to transfer certificates by contract.
Great. And we heard some testimony on this on Tuesday, but we did not finish. We're going to hear by phone from Steve Johnson now, and then we have one more person signed up to testify, Scott Bolton. If there's anybody else who's interested, make sure you let our committee assistant know. But at this moment, I'll turn over to Steve Johnson by phone. Steve, can you hear us?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Members of the committee, thanks for letting me call in by phone today to testify. I am in favor of House Bill 3571. I'm the manager of the Central Oregon Irrigation District. We serve over 7,000 folks in the Central Oregon area, over 44,000 acres of land. Back in 1989, the Central Oregon Irrigation District installed a hydroelectric facility on one of our irrigation canals, and this bill provides clarity for us as well as others that are in similar situation, other irrigation districts, municipalities, Indian tribes, and a few small private projects. A hydroelectric facility generates two commodities, or produces two commodities. One is the electricity that we sell to the local utility, Pacific Power, in our case with this project. But the other commodity that's produced is a renewable energy credit, which then becomes a certificate, or RECs is the acronym. And the RECs can be sold separately from the electricity. So the bill, we attempt to make it clear under Oregon law that those of us who own the projects also own the RECs that we produce, renewable energy credits. The Oregon Public Utility Commission has ruled that owners of projects built after 2005 own the RECs that they generate, but the Oregon law is currently silent on who owns the RECs for projects built before 2005. The PUC wasn't comfortable deciding this case a few months ago, but Representative Clem on Tuesday, I believe, provided information to the committee on the PUC support for this. Discussions have also been had with Pacific Core recently, and from what I understand, as had been brought forward on Tuesday, I believe some changes will be proposed for this bill going forward. The issue at hand with the REC ownership, for clarification, is that in order to market or to sell the RECs, you have to be able to demonstrate outright ownership. And the RECs can be sold not only in Oregon, but also in California at this point. And so it's that clarification of ownership that in order to sell these RECs is very important. An interesting aspect about potentially selling RECs into California is that there is no market for RECs in the state of Oregon, at least for the next few years. The utilities are, from what I understand, fully loaded with the credits that they need to meet the renewable portfolio standard by 2015, and so we won't have a market until after that point. But there is a market in California right now. So we can actually, if California utilities buy the RECs from our projects in Oregon, we're going to be able to get California money, basically subsidizing and providing monies to Oregon. And there are no costs to the state of Oregon, and there are no costs to the Oregon ratepayers when these RECs are sold. That's the conclusion of my testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions if we have any.
Great. Thank you. Let's see if there are questions. Representative Krieger.
What kind of dollars might we be talking California might pay? I'd love to see a lot of payment.
From what I understand, because I haven't built them specifically myself, but what I understand the market value in California is approximately $18 a rec, which is equivalent to 1,000 kilowatt hours. That's the potential price. And I could do a little bit extra math. And so if you have 1,000 RECs to sell and you get $18 a REC, that's $18,000 that before you would have zero.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, we'll bring up the next witness. Steve, you're welcome to stay on the line, or we can drop you, whichever you prefer. In the meantime, I'll bring up Scott Bolton.
You still there?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs, committee members. Scott Bolton, representing Pacific Corp. We serve Oregon as Pacific Power, about 550,000 customers, mostly a rural power company in the state. And therefore, our footprint puts us in the path or in the area where we have a lot of these small generators, whether they're hydro or biomass. We're starting to see more solar on our system. And so that geographic diversity for resources actually matches quite well with our service territory footprint. I'm speaking for Pacific Corp, although I think some of the issues I'm raising today isn't limited to just Pacific Corp. I've talked to members of other utilities, and I think they share some of the concerns that I'm raising. But I do think that the issues implicated by House Bill 3571 are more acutely felt by a company like ours, and I'll go into some detail. I will also say this. There's two truisms I've come across since becoming aware of this bill. The first is what seems like a really simple idea can often become pretty complex pretty quickly, as we're learning as we examine the implications of this legislation, and also that you can't get parties in the room talking to each other soon enough in the process. And that's starting to happen, and I'm confident that we can arrive at a good place. But at this point, the bill as introduced, we have significant concerns about. The first primary concern is that the bill as written is overly broad. So I am aware of the correspondence between PUC Commissioner Savage and Representative Clem, and I am very familiar with the PUC's order around REC ownership going to generators. These are only in cases of PURPA contracts, and PURPA is the Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act of 1978. It's a federal law that obligates utilities to buy the output of qualifying facilities. The PUC discussion, as well as what Commissioner Savage has communicated to Representative Clem, is focused only on those QF contracts, as we call them. The language as currently written would also apply to power purchase agreements under our interpretation. Those are bilateral, willing party contracts, not mandated by federal or state law, although there is some regulation as we are regulated. Company doing business in the state, we were very uncomfortable with the idea of the legislature settling either issues that are disputed or issues that are silent within existing contracts between two parties. So the first recommendation we have for this legislation is to be much more specific that we're talking only about those contracts that come in under PURPA. And I believe that really is the preponderance of the facilities that we're talking about are these QF contracts. But we do have power purchase agreements that are older than 2005 that may be silent on REC ownership that we think is probably inappropriate for the legislature to come in and determine an outcome to a contract term. The second item is, and I'm still not sure that while this is a bill to determine clarity, that there is clarity, is when exactly the production from these facilities as registered and as they become a renewable energy certificate when that starts. These contracts are older, some dating back to 1983. Some have about a year or two left on them. Others have significantly more lifespan on them. These are contracts that are not clarified through the PUC's order in 2005, which looked at contracts going forward. These are existing contracts that fall into this area. I think we agree with the proponents of the legislation that it would be helpful to have clarity, but we are concerned about the renewable portfolio standard and emissions implications if retroactivity is applied to these contracts. So for instance, if the intent of this bill is to award the environmental attributes, whether it creates a wreck or not, of these projects to the facility owner, going back to when the contract was entered into, that does have some exposure, some costs, and some risks for our customers, since not just in Oregon but in other states, we represent these facilities as clean energy or at least emissions-free energy, and that can be represented through either greenhouse gas reporting, emissions reporting standards, and what baselines we've submitted to different air quality agencies in the six states that we serve, as well as in some states where there are renewable portfolio standards, such as California, these facilities are included in our RPS baseline. So right now, California recognizes that these facilities are producing potentially renewable energy for our compliance with the California law. If the state of Oregon determines on a retroactive basis that the environmental attributes no longer belong to the customers of Pacific Power, that would have implications for our ability to meet the California RPS. So, again, simple idea, and we are very sympathetic with the folks who are offering this legislation. These are some risks that we've identified. We do want to work constructively to satisfy those risks, cover those off, so there's a no-harm effect of passing this bill. One other item I would also raise. So after this hearing, later today, I do have a meeting scheduled with Representative Clem. We do have some amendment language that we have offered to the proponents, and we'll bring to Representative Clem's attention. Another issue that is implicated by this bill, I don't think is entirely encompassed by this bill, but what we're seeing more and more as utility companies serving the state of Oregon is that the real lucrative REC markets are in California, are outside of our region. And so what we're seeing is a practice, and this is fine, this is legal, we don't dispute the practice, but what we're seeing are the generators linking up to our system under PURPA, under federal mandate. We pay for that energy at avoided costs at basically a regulated rate, and the environmental attributes and the emissions-free quality of those attributes are then sold off of our system. So what that does is for our generation mix, it is a growing component of undisclosed or undifferentiated or null power, however you define it. But it's power that is otherwise emissions-free or otherwise renewable, but we can't claim that credit because that REC has been, that derivative has been disassociated with the power. And so we are asking for language that will make it very clear in Oregon statute that despite whoever owns the REC, that the actual underlying emissions of the power is what is calculating both for resource labeling as well as for greenhouse gas reporting, so that we don't find ourselves in a situation where we're having system power mix or greenhouse gases imputed into these power sales and that we reflect more emissions than actually occur, if that makes sense.
Don't you have the option of purchasing these RECs?
Chair Cannon, we do. However, as Mr. Johnson articulated, at this point, my company, at least, has invested very aggressively and very heavily in renewables. We are doing pretty well, I would say, as far as meeting our RPS obligations. So the incremental cost of buying these RECs on top of the avoided cost power is just not a very prudent investment for our customers. And frankly, we would be competing against REC market prices in California, which is very very much more than what we would pay generated off of our own system.
And so can you clarify for what purpose you would want the credit of clean power, not for RPS purposes, right. Because for those purposes you have to hold the rack
exactly
to comply. But there was greenhouse gas reporting
and for resource labeling. So every utility is required to disclose to its customers the resources that they use. What is in your electricity? Basically like a food label. And as the environmental attributes are separated from the power, we start getting into a situation where we have a growing slice of the pie chart that shows up as undisclosed or undifferentiated power. And so we're not really asking for anything new. What we're asking for is clarification to make sure that whatever the emissions source is of that power is reflected, even though we're not claiming RPS right. eligibility
and,
for that.
And there's some barrier power. In the law to allowing you to classify that little wedge as green, as emission-free, if in fact it is?
Remember, we also serve five other states, and so the different states that we serve are in different places on this issue. But as far as I know, for the greenhouse gas reporting rule right now with DEQ, they do not impute system power into what we would call QF power, and that's a good thing. So one agency currently is looking at this issue and I think deciding right, but we don't have that clarity going forward. And this will be a growing issue in all of our states, even in California, where our system is much lower cost than the big three utilities down there, and they really comprise the bulk of the growing renewable energy and renewable energy certificate market.
That's good. I appreciate you being here. If there are representatives.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The situation calls out for uniformity, obviously, across these states. That's not anywhere on the horizon, I wouldn't think. So when we deal with the device, it's in light of these different means of managing it, whether it be in Idaho or California or Washington. And so I'm struck by how challenging it's going to be going forward without that uniform approach. So is there something federal that you guys are recommending?
Representative, I don't think that there's a federal solution to this particular issue at this point, unless the EPA came out and said, for this type of situation, here's how we're going to treat it. We kind of are in uncharted territories where through state renewable portfolio standards, we've created a new marketplace. And what we're starting to see are the implications of that marketplace, both the economic opportunities that they provide. And again, we salute those Oregon developers who can develop a clean energy resource and be able to market that power in a way to benefit themselves and their local communities. But you do start running into these situations where you also want to make sure that there's no harm that comes from the development of these markets, one of which is that it's unclear how to treat this power. One other comment I have is that on the ownership, on the very, you know, the fundamental premise of this legislation, Oregon is taking a step here by declaring in statute that the renewable energy associated with these projects stays with the generators as a matter of state law. Regulatory commissions across the West have addressed this issue and have frankly fallen in different places. So, for instance, the state of Wyoming, under their interpretation of PURPA, when a utility is obligated to buy the power, they buy everything associated with the power, not just the electrons, but the attributes associated with that power. Oregon has gone a different direction. We think, for the most part, the 2005 order that the commission has put in place settles that question, but it really only settles the question for investor-owned utilities that are commission-regulated. So this is still probably a contract discussion that occurs when a consumer-owned utility would go into a purchase arrangement under PURPA. The other piece is, you know, we are talking about older contracts before the real value in these markets emerge. So I'm not sure how big of an issue or problem this is as far as ownership of these attributes going forward, because everybody's very tuned into their value.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I was just curious if you think you have identified in your amendments all of the many varied ways that this issue might come up. Because, yes, so do you think you have?
Representative Vance, we've taken our best shot at it. I've described this bill as kind of an onion because each time we peel back a layer, we find something else. And, you know, to think that something as simple of an idea as what this legislation is premised on could have implications for California greenhouse gas cap and trade program compliance was pretty, I'm sure, is pretty far from the author's minds. But these are the risks that we've identified with the legislation. I think we do have some remedies for that. And as I said, we will endeavor to continue working with parties to get to a positive place.
Appreciate that, Scott. Appreciate your testimony. I don't think there's anyone else here to testify on this bill, so we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3571. Stay tuned for additional work on that bill. Mr. Co-Chair.
Any warnings for him going to Clem's office, or do you think it's okay?
He knows Clem well enough, I think. Mr. Johnson, well, Mr. Johnson's off. We will, that's okay. So let's go next to open a public hearing on House Bill 3165. And we have Liz to tell us a little about the bill and then a sign-up sheet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3165 would limit the circumstances under which the Water Resources Department could approve applications to change water uses that amount to more than 500 or more acre feet and that affect one or more water rights in federal storage projects in the Willamette Basin.
Great. Mr. Landauer, Mr. Sussman, and Todd Heidgerkin. I gave it a shot.
That was great.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Cannon, members of the committee. My name is Markel Landauer. I represent the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Our association has approximately 900 member districts, some of whom provide potable water. Today, I'd like to thank both the co-chairs of the committee for scheduling House Bill 3165. I'm joined by Mr. Sussman, who is a water resources consultant, and Mr. Heidgerkin, who is with Tualatin Valley Water District. Just so everyone's clear, our testimony today will be focused on the Dash 2 amendments, which replace the printed bill. Any materials that we have passed out today that says one, just imagine a two there instead. We got this amendment late, this morning. So just want to be clear on that. Generally speaking, House Bill 3165 is about having a discussion about water that is impounded behind 13 federally operated storage facilities in the Willamette Basin. Those storage facilities are called out in the amendment. I would like to also just give you one little note. These 13 federal storage facilities, when full in a good water year, can store up to approximately 1.64 million acre feet of water. I took out my abacus this morning, and I just so you can have a sense for how much water that is, it's 534,395,640,000 gallons of water. So with that, it's a lot of water. And with that, I'd like to just turn this over to Mr. Sussman, and I'll act as the remote control for you from this point on.
Thanks, sir.
Okay, good afternoon. My name is Adam Sussman. I'm a water resources consultant with a company called GSI Water Solutions, and this testimony is, like Mark said, on behalf of the Oregon Water Utilities Council. And co-chair Cannon, with your blessing, I'll move forward.
Yeah, please proceed.
Okay. So what I'm going to do is I know you guys have a lot on your plate and a lot of stuff going past your desk, so I just want to kind of stand back, go up about 30,000 feet, and give you kind of a feel for what is the issue and kind of what's going on the ground. So Mark has covered some of that already. We're talking about the 13 projects in the Southern Willamette Basin mostly, and I'll show a picture of those in just a minute. And they have what's called conservation storage. When they have actual usable storage of about 1.64 million acre feet. Those projects were, as the slide shows you, they were authorized by Congress in two different acts, mostly for flood control. Which is a great blessing for the Willamette Basin, but they were also authorized by Congress for a whole host of other things, including irrigation, making sure that they were releasing water in the summer to float boats for navigation, hydropower pollution abatement, and, of course, of great interest to the Water Utility Council is for water supply. Thanks, Mark. Next slide. So you have this handout with you just to give you a sense of where the projects lie. Again, they're mostly in the southern part of the basin. And again, they're in the most populous basin in the state of Oregon. And just to kind of diverge a little bit, not only from the geography here, but if you're in the business I'm in of thinking about future water supply in the Willamette Basin, those reservoirs are really the only game in town. So if you're a municipality and you're thinking about your future, you're going to be looking towards those reservoirs. Okay. So just in terms of the use of the stored water, I just want to back up a step and talk about that. Those reservoirs, those 13 reservoirs, are actually covered by State of Oregon water rights, because if you appropriate the state's water and use it for a beneficial use, it requires a water right. So there's actually two water rights that cover the 13 projects. They're certificated water rights, which means they're at the end of the process. And those water rights allow to store that water for irrigation only. Okay, so I'm going to say that one more time. Those projects are covered by two water rights, and when you read the water right, it says to store water for irrigation. Okay? And those water rights are currently held by the Bureau of Reclamation. Okay? And with those storage projects and with those water rights, the Bureau of Reclamation initiated a contracting program. And to date, since all that happened in the 60s, we have about 80,000 acre feet, about 80,000 of the 1.64 contracted and used for irrigation. Okay? So what have we been doing? And as Representative Bentz will recall, I'm sure, this is not a new issue.
Mr. Sussman, yes. Can I I want to interrupt just to make sure I understand. So the two water rights that the Bureau of Rec holds is for all of the stored water, and it's eligible only for irrigation purposes.
That's correct.
Which means that none of the stored water is being used for other purposes. Obviously, flood control but in terms of consumptive use, there are not other purposes to which that water is being put presently.
That's correct.
In any of the 13 impoundments.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
So as I was saying, as Representative Bentz may remember, this is not a new issue. The municipal water suppliers in the Willamette Basin have been looking at this water, trying to figure out how to work cooperatively with the state and the federal agencies to have access to that water for future water supply. And this started in the early 90s through a bunch of rulemaking with the Water Resources Commission that Representative Bentz was on. There was actually a request to reserve some of that stored water back in 1994. And then in 1996, Congress actually allocated some money to the Army Corps of Engineers. And I neglected to say that the Army Corps of Engineers actually operates and manages these projects, even though the water rights are held by the Bureau of Reclamation. They authorized a general investigation study in 1996, which is called the Willamette Basin Reservoir Study. And what we did in that study is we got stakeholders to the table and said, okay, we've got a lot of water here, and we've got a lot of diverse interest in this water. How are we going to allocate this water to the interest? Because this 1.64 million acre feet in these reservoirs is not divvied up amongst the uses. It's just there. And so that's what this whole process was in 1996, to get all the stakeholders to the table and figure out how to do that. We had a great conversation. We made a lot of progress. But unfortunately, in the year 2000, it stopped. And the reason it stopped was because we had some listing of anadromous fish under the Endangered Species Act in the Willamette Basin. So the Army Corps of Engineers had to stop the conversation and go into consultation. Well, that process took 8 years. And so we had 8 years of no conversation. In 2008, the biological opinion was issued. It established flow targets for the listed fish. And what we're concerned about is, since that biological opinion has been issued, we haven't gotten back to the table. This just is a kind of a snapshot of what's going on today. Some of these numbers haven't really changed that much. Again, the irrigation I talked about, you know, it was about 80,000 acre feet, about 5%. And then you'll see the yellow box, that's flow augmentation. And this kind of goes back to Co-Chair Cannon's question. Well, what's going on with that water? Well, a lot of that water is just being released from the projects. And in fact, the projects are currently being managed today to meet the flow requirements of the biological opinion. That's a really important point. They're managing the projects today to release stored water to meet the flow targets in the biological opinion. And so this bill, the municipal water providers are not interested in taking that water or arguing that the fish shouldn't need that water. And I just want to make it clear that the targets that are set out in the biological opinion are currently being met. And then that, of course, leaves about 62% of the water that we haven't really talked about. And just really quickly, why has it been so hard for the municipal water providers to get access to this water? This is the list. One thing is, as Representative Cannon suggested, it's because the water right is only for irrigation. So if I want to go as a municipality and ask the state of Oregon, hey, can I use some of that stored water for municipal use? They'd say, I'm sorry, the water right now is for storing this water for irrigation. And you're not asking for irrigation water. So that's an impediment. We also have been working through the federal formula to understand what would the cost of that water be for a municipality. It's not really clear whether the Army Corps of Engineers is that interested in being the contracting authority. And really, we need to have this kind of coordinated discussion about what's going to happen with that water. If I'm going to plan to spend a bunch of time and money on infrastructure to go after this stored water, I'm going to want to know how much is there for me and my fellow municipalities to use. And so what does this bill do? What it really does is it kind of forces us back to where we were in 2000 and establishes really a framework for talking about how are we going to allocate this water. There is significant public interest in this stored water and how it's going to be allocated. And what this bill does is it has the state of Oregon saying, look, we want to ensure that there's a deliberate, inclusive process that minimizes unintended consequences when we're acting to do things with this water. Okay? And one of those unintended consequences could be to adversely affect somebody that already has a water right on a river. Okay? And it forces the conversation about how is this water going to be allocated equitably. And finally, it recognizes that, look, this water isn't just for municipal use. It's going to be to meet the biological opinion. It's going to be for flat water recreation. It's going to be for a whole bunch of reasons. So what's the alternative if we do nothing? What we are concerned about, and I think a lot of people would share this concern, is that we're going to miss an opportunity to sort of codify, if you will, this formal process to meet a lot of diverse needs. And really, without this bill, there's really no clear process for the state or any of the stakeholders to be involved in how the federal agencies might make some of these decisions with this significant amount of water. Some stakeholders could be excluded. And frankly, without this kind of process, that everyone, by the way, is sort of headed into in a very cooperative way today, but without that, we could have a whole bunch of money being spent needlessly over litigation about who's doing what the water and who's going to get what and how it's all going to work out. So I appreciate the opportunity to give you this. We look for your support for House Bill 3165 and we're happy to answer questions as the chair sees fit. Thank you.
Let's hear from the last panelist and check on questions.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Todd Heigerkin. I'm here on behalf of Special Districts Association of Oregon and the Oregon Water Utility Council, but also work for a water utility that actually has water rights on the Willamette River. The real question, or really what I wanted to do, is just kind of reaffirm some of the points from a utility perspective that Mr. Sussman brought up, and that kind of stressing the reasons why municipalities are interested in this type of a solution. And first off, as a municipality, we have a responsibility to serve the growing communities within the areas that we serve, that we provide water to. And as part of that, we have what's called a duty to serve. And this is actually a legislatively mandated requirement that we have to make sure that we provide water to those folks that are within the area that we serve. So what is required in order to fulfill that duty is to make sure that we are being diligent in our long-term water supply planning. If you look at, many of the water resource projects that we enjoy and use today, that was really a result of people that had a lot of foresight and planning and thinking ahead many, many decades ago. And so it's not uncommon for a municipality to approach a water supply planning project to look at 50 years or more. In fact, the utility I work for, we do a water system master plan, which looks at 50-year demand horizons. We include those demand horizons within our water management and conservation plan, and we actually do a 50-year financial model to make sure that we're adequately saving up our resources and being prepared to allocate those resources to meet those needs, those capital needs in the future. A second thing is as any other water user or in-stream interest or anything, we too are facing limited water supply options. And as Mr. Sussman pointed out, this is obviously an option that's attractive just given its quantity, scale, and location as it relates to the population base in the Willamette Valley. And then third, even though municipal water use is an authorized use as part of the reservoirs, municipalities, for the reasons that Mr. Sussman pointed out, are unable to access that federal stored water. And so we have been working for a number of years to try to identify the process for us and others to be involved. Not to repeat what Mr. Sussman pointed out, but he listed, on one of his slides, listed a number of different activities from the Willamette Basin Program to the Municipal Reservation on the Willamette, which there's multiple reservations. There's a reservation for agricultural irrigation as well. The Willamette Basin Study, we're working with the Army Corps of Engineers on a small-scale study as well. And the point that I really want to make is that we have continued to participate in the process for all of these years with not only our time, but our resources, our financial resources as well, even though, unfortunately, sometimes the process continues to change, which kind of brings me to my last point, and that's why are we encouraging support for House Bill 3165 with the -2 amendments. And that really goes to the fact that I guess we've been through a process where a variety of things have changed. And so I think what this does is provide some assurity or lays out a framework or a process that hopefully everybody can participate in. I believe, for clarification, the Army Corps of Engineers and the Bureau of Reclamation have recognized the need and have done a good job of trying to coordinate with us to providing some helpful background, some of the slides, the information that we've provided in the slides to the various interests. However, the role of the state and the various stakeholders has not really been clearly defined in this process. And that's really what these Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3165 seek to do. It's also evident that, you know, to be honest, we need to do a better job of understanding what all the different needs are for this resource. And I think the process that we've laid out allows for that discussion to occur as opposed to it just being simply some sort of water right processing action. And so this actually stimulates that discussion. And I think it's important to note that this is a water issue, and with any water issue, it's often complicated. It's never black and white, and it's a lot of times it takes a variety of amount of time to make sure that we bring everybody up to that same educational level as far as what's taking place and what that impact is on the resource, and I think this legislation allows that to do it. And then most importantly, and really kind of is one of the things that kind of instigated our involvement more recently with this legislation, is just to make sure that there aren't any unintended consequences. I mean, I'll be honest, what brought us as kind of the eye-opening event was probably a year and a half ago. I may have the timing a little bit off. We had an opportunity to meet with the Army Corps of Engineers and the Bureau of Reclamation, where they told us that they were planning to submit the transfer application to transfer all of this water. And at that point, there had been no stakeholder involvement about how that was going to occur. And unfortunately, what that would have done is probably initiated kind of those last two bullet points on Mr. Sussman's slides. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony to provide sort of a municipal perspective and would encourage the committee's support for the Dash 2 on behalf of OWOC and SDAO.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has the federal government had done something that would allow this reallocation, relabeling of the stored water in the last 20 years? Because my recollection had been that there was some restriction at the federal level that would prevent what you just mentioned might happen from happening. Has that changed?
The Co-Chair Cannon and Representative Benz, things pretty much got put on hold until the biological opinion was issued. And when that was issued recently, then that kind of stimulated the discussion where their focus became more how are we going to meet those biop flows. As far as federal restrictions, I'm not familiar with anything that's actually restricted our ability. Does that make sense?
Well, you know, my recollection was that the projects were built for irrigation and flood control purposes, and that any change outside that scope would require federal legislation. Is that recollection incorrect?
Co-Chair Cannon, Representative Benz, you're right. There's actually kind of two processes that go on. One is the state water right, and that is really just a state process, just like any water right transfer. If you want to change it from irrigation to multi-purpose use or municipal, that process has not changed. What does require some sort of federal activity is the allocation of the water. So in other words, the water in those projects is for multiple purposes, as I listed. And if we want to go through a formal process to say, this much is going to go for irrigation and this much is going to go for municipal use, then that does require a federal process. And it depends on how big of a bite you want to take in terms of what the process is. We're currently engaged in a process with the Army Corps of Engineers to do that for 500 acre feet, and that can actually be done at the district level. We're doing that because we want to learn the answers to some of these questions. If we reallocate it to municipal use, how much will it cost us? Will it actually be there? What does the environmental review look like? So yes, you are correct. The reallocation of the water, which is kind of what would have to happen here, would include some federal process. Yes.
Thank you.
How does this bill create water possibilities for municipalities that aren't available today? I'm pretty focused on the bill now. So it appears to set up a process, but help me out with understanding how this actually helps.
Well, Co-Chair Cannon and members of the committee, I mean, it's a great question. I think what it does is it provides us an opportunity to be at the table while these discussions take place. In other words, let me say it differently. If we do nothing, I'll kind of paint like a really disastrous example. If we do nothing and the federal agencies take some sort of action and they protect that water in a way that we don't have access to it and there's no contracting program for municipal use, we will sort of stand by and watch this opportunity go away. And so what this bill does is actually preserves the opportunity to come to the table, to be part of the allocation discussion that we just described, to ensure that there is, in fact, a dedicated piece of the reservoirs for municipal use.
And Water Resources Department wouldn't have that authority already. Without this bill, they wouldn't have a chance to review the federal proposal and establish a process or criteria that would assure you some piece of it.
Now, Co-Chair Cannon and members of the committee know their review of the water right transfer would be very, very narrow and would not provide them the opportunity to sort of get into this more sort of public interest dialogue about how that water should be allocated. That's correct. They do not have that authority today.
Okay, then my last question, why this 1,500 acre feet threshold under which this process would not be triggered, but after which it would?
Well, Co-Chair Cannon and members of the committee, that's a great question. We worked with a lot of stakeholders to make sure that we could develop a bill that was acceptable to everybody. And there were a few stakeholders, including the Water Resource Department, that said, you know, let's be careful that we don't, quote, lock down the system, if you will, without leaving a little bit of room for something that none of us can anticipate today. So there's no specific science to why the 1,500 number. We all felt like it was a good number, but that's what it is. It's to just make sure that if someone wanted to come in with a transfer for something we can't anticipate today and our small-scale study that we're working on, that there'd be enough room for that.
Okay. And it's the first, it's a sort of cumulative amount. So the first 1,500 wouldn't undergo this process, or am I misreading the bill?
Co-Chair Cannon, the way we believe it reads is that it kicks in once you get to 1,500. Sure. So if you had a 500, a 500, the third 500 would sort of trigger, anything after that would trigger the process.
Okay. Thank you. We'll bring up a few more folks. We have Katie Fast, Patrick Capper, and Chris Fick, and then Brenda from the department. You'll be on deck.
Thank you very much.
So wrap things up. Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Sat down first, Katie. So.
Okay, I'll go.
Why don't you start?
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. And the Oregon Farm Bureau is in support of the -2 amendments. We actually assisted the Oregon Water Utilities Council and other stakeholders in drafting these amendments to bring them forward. As you've heard, the Willamette Basin Project is a unique water system in the state. And we believe it requires a unique solution to move forward on the management of that water. The stored water in the system is designated for irrigation purposes, and so agriculture may have the most to lose if a transfer moves forward. And we are concerned over a potential transfer coming forward that would change the use from irrigation to other purposes. And that's why we support bringing a group of stakeholders together to find a recommendation to the water resources that's appropriate use of the water and brings in the multiple needs in terms of the resource and the different interests in terms of municipal agriculture and other economic purposes together to have that discussion. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Kapper with the Oregon Association of Nurseries. We, too, were invited early on in the process to help craft language and direction and believe that we've reached an area where we are very comfortable supporting the bill, the Dash 2s. The OAN supports House Bill 3165 because it would ensure that we maintain critical state involvement with regard to significant decisions about the future of the Willamette Valley's largest water project. Many of my members depend upon water stored in this area to irrigate their crops and to provide mitigated water for aquatic ecosystems. Like I said, we worked hand-in-hand with other supporters of this bill to develop a sensible and appropriate process to protect our members' present and future interests within the context of this unique situation. This broad coalition of supporters represents a significant majority of the Willamette Valley's residents, and it's not often that you see these groups come together and agree, but in this case, we believe this bill will help ensure a plentiful water supply for all of our constituents in the future, and I'm happy to answer any questions as well.
Thanks.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, other members of the committee. Chris Fick with the League of Oregon Cities. My testimony will be short and brief. I just want to emphasize the importance of this region of our state, not only to its residents, but to the state's economy. The Willamette Basin is home to 2.5 million Oregonians. 80% of those residents receive their drinking water from municipal providers, cities, and special districts. While this region only comprises 14% of the state, generates 75% of the state's economic activity. Just to give another context in which to think about the amount of water behind these stored dams, and 1 acre foot is generally thought to be enough to provide water for a 4-member suburban household. So we're talking annually about enough water to provide drinking water for 1.64 million households in Oregon. So there's a lot of water. We think that Oregonians should be involved in the process of determining how to equitably and fairly distribute that water. We encourage you to support 3165.
Thanks. Other questions? Thank you all.
Thanks.
Brenda, you want to come on
in? Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brenda Bateman with the Oregon Water Resources Department, and I think a lot of the history that I have included in my testimony you've heard already today, so I'll fast forward and wanted to just confirm or clarify a couple of things that have already been discussed this afternoon. First and foremost, this bill really harkens back to a conversation that was underway and taking place in the 1990s, but was placed on hold during the development of the biological opinion. So we believe this is picking up in a sense of a discussion that was going well that needed to continue. When the biological opinion came out, one of the recommendations that was in there, and I think this was mentioned briefly, but I wanted to put a fine point on it, one of the recommendations in the biological opinion is to actually transfer water from irrigation to multipurpose use. So that is something that is definitely on the federal radar as part of the formal biological opinion and is underway with the wheels moving today. So this is a process that's been triggered, and I believe the stakeholders, as I understand it, have put this bill forward to make sure that they have a place at the table and a part in the discussion. I wanted to clarify or confirm as well a prior point, and that is what the department has the ability to do today with regard to these transfers. So under current law, the ability to comment on or protest a pending transfer application is much more limited than it would be for an original or new water right application. When considering a water right transfer, the department is limited to considering whether already existing water rights would be injured by this transaction. So in the case of many of the stakeholders that are in the room, if they do not yet hold a water right or contract for that water, they don't really have a voice in the process. And so I think that's probably the basic concern that they're trying to address with this bill. We're very limited in who we can, what we can consider and who we can hear from during a transfer transaction process. With that, I'm happy to... Oh, the last point I wanted to make, and you may have some questions about the money involved here. This will involve some staffing. We're happy to host this conversation as we did previously in the 1990s. It would have a fiscal impact, of course, to convene this, these stakeholders and produce the type of report and recommendations that are sought in this bill. But also, as noted in the Dash 2 amendments, funding would come from an outside source and would not be a draw on the general fund. So I just wanted to make sure you had seen that point as well. I'm happy to take any questions.
Can you, Brenda, thank you. Can you go back to the second point about who has standing in the process today versus a bill that tries to expand the table? Help me understand if this bill was not to pass, the federal government decides they're going to transfer some of the water from one purpose to another. What happens? Who can participate in that decision at the department's level, and what changes underneath this bill? I mean, I realize I'm trying to catch up on this issue, and it's complex. So we've probably heard the answer already, but help me out.
Mr. Chair, under our statutes and rules today, if someone is, if the federal government is proposing to transfer this water that's currently stored and used for agricultural purposes to other purposes, the only folks who would really have standing, as you say, in this conversation are people who already have water rights or contracts in this case to that water. So that if, so there are many people out there who do not have contracts. You've heard that none of the municipalities have contracts at all for this water, they would not have a voice in this process and would not be able to participate in weighing in on where allocations and distribution of this water would go in the future. It would only be folks who already have contracts or water rights, and so that would be limited to a few in the agricultural irrigated community.
Okay, let me see if there are other questions. Yeah, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brenda, just so I remember correctly, this situation is a bit odd in the sense that most of the time the water behind any reservoir in our state has been allocated for a purpose and then filed upon for purposes of application out of the stream someplace below the dam. This situation is odd in the sense that the water was filed upon by the Bureau for the 1.6 million acre feet behind the dam, but that which is then let out of the dam and gone down the river, it has been very small. So that which remains behind the dam and not yet released from the dam, it has been unavailable for these last, ever since they were built. While people kind of stayed in place, the water has to be released every once in a while, and it is. So this discussion, this debate about how this water might be allocated, is to do exactly what? Because the water has to be released in any event. It's got to come out. So once the water comes out of the dam, is this debate about who can then make call upon it? Is that what we're really debating here? And who gets to weigh in that conversation?
Mr. Cotera and Representative, yes, I believe that with the water right that's in place, it's up to the Bureau to contract the stored water, and very little of that has been done, and it's only been for agricultural purposes. And so you're quite right. As water is released for a variety of purposes, or for flood control mostly, the question remains, how can this water be best allocated? And the folks who can be at the table today and weigh in on this conversation are a very narrow group of folks. It's very limited. So I believe this bill is in hearkening back to a process that was in place that involved a broader group in the 1990s.
But just so I'm clear on this, if we put a label on the water in the reservoir behind the dam, in this process, because that's what this process anticipates,
right,
then when the water is released, the folks, whoever it is, cities that have their name on a portion of that stored water could then have a right to file for a water right with the department to take that water out of the river. Once upon it's being released.
Co-chair, representative, it would be, the paperwork would actually be along the lines of a contract with the Bureau, but yes. Yes.
Kind of follow up. Well, and so the folks then, let's say the city enters into a contract with the Bureau because the Bureau has now decided to allocate stored water to two cities, then they, the cities, could call upon that water. Is that your anticipation? And thus reduce the level of water in the reservoir so those who have been water skiing on it are now upset and angry. Is that one of the consequences of this allocation?
Co-chair, representative, I am not going to get into the recreational uses portion of this discussion because I know it's held quite dear to many people. But yes, in the sense that the contract would be very specific about the timing and amount of water. It wouldn't just be a call at any time. It would be a set aside water with specific times, purposes, and volumes. Yes, folks would be looking to have their name, as you say, on a portion of that water and have it delivered downstream to their points of diversion. That would be the future use or the purpose.
And to this point, then, has the department exercised some care in? Let me back up. As the situation currently exists, water is released from the reservoir because it has to be. They have to empty that reservoir over a period of time. And when it comes out of the dam and enters the river, it's available for appropriation now because it's once upon being released with no one's name on it, it was viewed as available flow. Has the department looked at that and said, oh, that's stored water, we better not give that to anybody because someday the label on it may change? Or has the department issued water rights below these projects that can only be fulfilled if that water is released and available to fill those water rights?
Co-chairs, representative, I'm not aware of all of the cases and how that's worked, but generally that water has not been allocated. Generally, that stored water has not been allocated, as I understand it. That there's still the understanding that water has not been allocated.
Just for personal record, my understanding is slightly different, but I'm trying to remember back about 15 years, and I could be wrong. But my recollection, Mr. Chair, is that this is an issue that would be of great interest to hear from the department on in more detail, because my recollection is that indeed some of that water may have been treated as just available flow and not retained its stored label, if you will. And people may be relying upon those releases so they can then do whatever they're currently doing with the water.
Co-chair's representative, we're certainly happy to put together a more detailed report on what that looks like today.
Thank you.
So your concern, Representative Benz, is about the sort of double allocation.
No, Mr. Chair, my concern is that the water upon being released from, let's say, Detroit Dam, down the Santa Am, becomes available for appropriation. It's no longer stored water. It's just there. And so someone downstream may have filed for a water right on whatever might be in the stream.
Right.
And there might be a stored water component there, not a natural flow component.
Uh-huh.
So unwittingly, they may be relying upon stored water because it became available water when it was released. And so now, if we change the label on it, suddenly we have a dramatically over-appropriated situation where they could no longer use what now is labeled stored water.
Yeah, thanks. Any other questions? Brenda, just real quick, can you describe how the department would interpret this language in the bill related to the stakeholder group? It says, the Water Resources Director shall assemble a work group of affected stakeholders and federal agency representatives. What does that mean? Who are the affected stakeholders who you would envision convening?
Mr. Chair, we read this to be more inclusive rather than less. So we certainly have, in terms of an idea, folks who were gathered last time that included agricultural interests, municipal, environmental, and conservation groups. I think that has yet to be fully defined, and so we're certainly happy to take input on that. But we were wanting to err on the side of broader involvement rather than more narrow.
Okay, and then final question, which you don't have to answer now, it could be later, but the provision, one of the provisions under the work group's product related to granting the transfer or not would be ensuring that there's equitable provision of water needed to satisfy existing contract holders and water needed for present and future water needs. I mean, this language is intentionally sort of squishy, but any help that you can provide, what does it mean to equitably provide any water discussion turns into this, and
maybe that's the point, is to provide just a place for those conversations to happen. But my concern is that, you know, very much like the legislature, it can become a sort of political matter. What's equitable to one is not equitable to another. And are we just sort of kicking the can down the trail here? That's the concern.
Mr. Chair, I think that's it's a valid concern. It's definitely a term that's not defined here, and that's one of the reasons why, hearkening back to your first question, we would want to make sure that group is broader rather than narrower from the very beginning.
Great. Mr. Chair. Representative Goody.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things I like about the bill, Brenda, is what's already been stated, restarting the process involving your department again, and fairness. I think we're being prudent. I think we're really trying to be fair, and I think it's refreshingly balanced, because it's putting the needs, and more importantly, the future needs of people on the table along with fish. And so I don't know if you would agree, and you don't have to comment about, but I think, and it's a great question, but it's exactly the opposite of kicking it down the road, and we should be asking those questions. But I think this doesn't kick it down the road. This actually sets us up to be in place when some very serious, as we all know, it'll just get more serious, water issues come forward. So it's attractive to me in its balance and forethought. You can comment or you don't have to. You're going to go with no?
Just nod your head.
Thank you.
And I guess my last comment would be to, I know whenever you do work groups, it puts a burden on the department. I know it costs money, but Phil Ward's not here. He's obviously taken off early. And if he's got that kind of extra time, he could do these work groups, don't you think? It wouldn't cost any.
Mr. Kutcher, I'll pass that along.
Thank you, Brenda. We're going to have to move along. There's some interest in bringing back Mr. Sussman. We've got another bill to hear. I would appreciate follow-up with anyone who wants to talk more about this in my office. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3165 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3121. We were expecting and planning to hear from Representative Kenemer, but we'll actually end up carrying over, I think, the hearing so that we can hear from him when he's back in the Capitol. In the meantime, we'll get the sheet and bring up Scott Bruin from the Marine Board. And why don't we start with you? I recognize it's not your bill.
You want Liz to do an overview?
Yeah, Liz, why don't you do an overview while I consult with my co-chair?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3121 would eliminate the requirement that a person operating a manually propelled boat obtain an aquatic invasive species prevention permit.
All right. This is unusual. Representative Kenemer's not here. We're forging ahead anyway. It's his bill, and you, sir, are listed here as opposing it, as are the other two folks who have signed up. So I'll ask the committee to try to keep an open mind about this. We're not hearing from its proponent, Representative Kenemer, but we will on a future date. And Scott, why don't you tell us your perspective on this issue?
Okay. Co-chairs Cannon and Gilliam, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Bruin, director of the Oregon State Marine Board. I'm here today to provide testimony for House Bill 3121. The Marine Board is opposed to this bill. Non-motorized boaters appear in the governor's balanced budget. This bill would result in a 37% decrease in anticipated revenue in 1113 to the Aquatic Invasive Species Program. The Aquatic Invasive Species Prevention Fund was established in the 2009 legislative session, with revenues being generated from registered boats, non-resident motor boats, and manually propelled boats 10 feet or more in length. The AIS Prevention Fund is completely self-funded, a program that operates without any financial assistance from the state general fund or any other agency budget. All revenues from the permit sales are deposited in the AIS Prevention Fund. That fund is used for education, for inspection, and for response if there's an infestation of invasive species that we need to eradicate. The ramifications of this lost revenue will impact all of those areas, or potentially some of those areas as a result. For example, right now in Oregon, we do have the New Zealand mud snail is active in Oregon along the coast. It's spread along the coast considerably over the past many years, primarily because people don't know how to clean things that go into the water. It could be boats, it could be boots, it could be anything that has contact with infested water. It could be waders, it could be buckets. Anything that these small organisms can attach to can then transfer those organisms to another water body. On November 1st, 2010, a California Agricultural Inspection Station quarantined a sea kayak coming out of Lake Mead. That kayak had 15 quagga mussels attached to the skeg box. Given that it was in November, had that kayak made it past that inspection station and had it been heading for Oregon, it likely would have come up here with those mussels still being alive when it entered Oregon. It is a misconception that the only threat for transported species is motorized boats. In fact, the Western Regional Panel on Aquatic Nuisance Species stated adult mussels are hardy and can survive out of water for up to 5 days in warm, dry weather and up to 30 days in cool, moist weather. Adults can easily spread between water bodies by watercraft, especially when protected in the crevices of trim tabs, keels, engines, propellers, and anchors. In addition, they may be moved with equipment, trailers, water tanks, construction equipment, fish for stocking, water-based aircraft, firefighting equipment, bait buckets, anglers, and other recreational water equipment. We did convene a stakeholders group in September. We're only a year into this program. We convened a group in September which included both motorized boaters, non-motorized boaters, Portland State University, the Oregon Invasive Species Council, to find out how the program was going and what changes we should make to that program. That committee had consensus that it was a good program, and what we were doing with the program was meeting their needs. However, they did offer some additional assistance. There was some concerns about the tag that non-motorized boaters were receiving. What they recommended is a two-year tag using a Tyvek tag that can be exposed to water and nothing will happen to it. So we have adopted that. The board adopted that in January, and we have implemented that two-year tag, which makes it easier for folks to display it so law enforcement knows that you already have your permit. They don't have to stop you and ask, as well as providing that you only have to get it every 2 years instead of yearly. You can buy that tag at the Marine Board offices or by mail. There is no additional charge, just the $5 charge per year for that tag. There's no additional charge when you get it through the Marine Board. In the coming biennium, we need to continue education. This is a new program. People still don't know of the requirements. They still don't know how to properly clean their vessels. We need to get that information out to them. We still need to work on minimizing the spread within Oregon, and we need to work on ensuring that new invasive species do not come into Oregon through the inspection program that we have in place through Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. So that is my testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Brayden. See if there are any questions. None from members of the committee. Stick around in case anything comes up.
One question.
Yeah, Representative Krieger.
You got a certain number of boat licenses sold. And how's the number of permits people are getting for this compared to the boats sold, realizing that there's all these that are not licensed? Because they're manual. Is there any correlation that you can look at to figure that even all of your licensed boats are complying?
Chair Cannon, Representative Krieger, right now we have what we're estimating is about a 25% compliance rate from non-motorized boats. because motorized boats, their fee is included in the registration. All of those boats are automatically paid in, and then the non-motorized, that's what's been part of the difficulty, is notifying folks and making sure that they're aware of the requirement.
Was there any discussion in the work group of the fee associated with non-compliance? One of the concerns that Representative Kennemer shared with me was sense that the fee was out of proportion, the fine for not holding a permit out of proportion to the cost of the permit itself.
Yeah, Chair Cannon, that is a concern. That is the lowest in our bail schedule. That is the lowest fine that we have available. It's a $99 fine, and then with the court fees added on to it, makes it, I think, about $147. So it is a very large fine for that failure to get the permit. It is something that we've been working with law enforcement to make sure that our primary focus is education, not on actually enforcing that aspect of the permit process.
Right, and information that our committee staff compiled for us, based, I think, on conversations with your staff or you, indicated that there have been approximately 7 citations. I think you're depending on reporting from counties and local law enforcement, but is that roughly the number that we should have in your mind, in our minds, or?
Chair Cannon, we've had 7 violations that we have given a citation for. In some of those cases, I would say at least half of them I've read the whatever narrative was available. There were additional citations provided to the boater. Not only were they did not have the permit, they did not have an adequate number of life jackets. They were probably missing some other things as well.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much. We'll hear Tom Wolf and Ryan Hook.
Hello.
Hi.
Chair Cannon, Chair Gilliam, committee members. My name is Tom Wolf. I'm the chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. As Trout Unlimited helped support the bill that was passed in 2009 that created this fee. As such, we come before you to say that TU is empathetic, is emphatic and energetic in opposition to this bill. Currently, one of the crucial issues facing us in this country is the invasion of non-native fish, wildlife, and vegetated invasive species. They figure that, according to some surveys I've done, they figure that the costs in lost revenue, lost recreational abilities, cleaning out water pipes, hydroelectric facilities, cost this country $137 billion a year. And now on the invasive sides, we have some really crummy invasive species such as zebra mussels, quagga mussels, New Zealand mud snails that are invading. And what they do is they get into, they foul up the bottom of a stream and coat it, therefore allowing known micro and macro invertebrates to grow, thus causing fish to literally starve. They get inside water pipes and clog them up because zebra mussels, for example, they've figured that 70,000 of them are found in a cubic meter. They grow very fast, they grow very dense, and they get into hydroelectric in the Great Lakes where they're currently a big problem. They all the states in the Great Lakes where they affect the pipes and the dams and all the systems are spending millions and millions and millions of dollars a year trying to fix the problem. And so it is very important that we prevent them from coming into this state. And the best way to prevent those aquatic invasive species from entering the state is boat inspection stations. And having this fee is a crucial part of funding those boat inspection fees. I have, for the last 10 years, sat on the ODFW External Budget Advisory Committee, EBEC, and have advised them on before every session on their budget proposal, have been involved in 2 license fee increases and various things, and have been really working hard to help the agency, who I don't always agree with, and I sometimes testify against some of their things with, but I think that they're sincere people that want to do the right thing, and they need funding. And currently we're facing an issue with all natural resource departments that's being less and less general fund money going into them. So how do we deal with that? Well, we have to look at fee structure, other types of fees, and this non-motorized boat fee is the best possible way to fund this crucial bit of boat inspection stations. Finally, I think it's just important to, I've talked a lot to boat users, to people in my organization that own drift boats, to canoers, to kayakers. I've spent the last 2 years doing that. And these men and women love the waters of Oregon, and they realize that in order to protect the waters of Oregon, they're willing to pay this very minuscule fee. So I think that people realize how important it is. So in closing, I just ask that this bill be defeated, because it is something, the idea that our state could be invaded by quagga and zebra mussels from Lake Powell and from Nevada or from the Great Lakes coming on boats into our state. It's a scenario that must not and should not happen. Thank you.
Thanks, Doug.
For the record, my name is Ryan Hoof. I'm the 2011 chair of the Oregon Invasive Species Council. Co-chairs Cannon and Gilliam, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity today to speak and testify on behalf of the council in opposition of House Bill 3121. Non-indigenous species as a form of biological pollution are increasingly a threat to our natural resources in this state. If not prevented, these species can become invasive and result in significant ecological and economic consequences to our state. Recently, the Northwest Power and Conservation Council's independent economic advisory board produced a report stating that zebra and quagga mussels, if introduced to the region, could cost hundreds of millions of dollars per year, and they emphasized the importance of maintaining and increasing spending on prevention programs, not decreasing them. The Aquatic Invasive Species Prevention Program currently provides some critical services in the fight to limit the spread of these harmful species throughout the West. Those services include boater education, the ability to quickly respond to species if they're detected within our state waters, and boat inspections. In addition to generating revenue for these services, the permit system provides an important outreach mechanism for reaching groups that otherwise are difficult to speak with about the importance of cleaning their vessels and best management practices and just promoting general awareness. These boats, such as kayaks and other manually propelled vessels, need to be properly cleaned between uses in different different water bodies and watersheds. They can be a vector. It's been proven for a variety of different aquatic invasive species, not just zebra and quagga mussels, but New Zealand mud snails, which have been mentioned, a particularly unpleasant freshwater algae called Didymo, which also goes by the common name of rock snot and covers stream beds, which is not just unpleasant for recreational users, but also for the fish that inhabit those streams. This bill would significantly reduce the resources available for the program to meet its objectives and to combat the harmful effects of aquatic invasive species. Our council, which represents a cross-section of Oregon's government, agricultural, business, and user group interests, has voted unanimously in opposition to this bill in recognizing that House Bill 3121 represents a step backward in our ability to prevent the transport and introduction of aquatic invasive species. Just in conclusion, thank you for the opportunity to express the council's concerns and to encourage committee members to oppose House Bill 3121.
Thank you. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, Tom, you did a good job of reminding us why we passed this. And I've been schooled by Chair Roblin on this issue, and I agree with what you said about the importance of both of you. My first question, you don't really have to answer, but you're starting to remind me of me in the 07 session in consumer protection. We need you to come in here and be for something at some point. This bill, will you at least agree, because my friend Bill isn't here, we're going to have Bill Kinnear come back, that we do have a little pushback here, not about the importance of stopping invasive species, but maybe, and not about the fee, but maybe about our what we can do to tell more folks. I think the folks that you canoe with are very informed. I'm not as surprised about that. And maybe talk about the penalties. Do you agree that that's at least worth talking about?
Yeah, I do agree. Having Chair Gilliam, Chair Cannon, committee members, I do agree. I think that we do talk. I'm not saying that education isn't important. I'm just saying that we need to keep the funding for the Bowdoin Station. I mean, I spent the U of O Auburn football game in the same house with Representative Kennemer, and when he told me he was going to try to pass this bill, and it kind of ruined the game, plus the fact they lost. But so I've known about this for a long time, and I've been actually preparing what I said for a long time. So, I agree. I think we should talk about those issues.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there other questions? Seeing none, thank you both very much for your testimony. I'm going to close the carry over first the public hearing on House Bill 3121 to Tuesday to allow Representative Kennemer to testify. Don't expect, given that agenda, we'll be able to take additional public testimony that day, but we will let the representative say his piece. With that, close the public hearing on House Bill 3121, and seeing no further business, adjourn the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water.